Well, let me start by saying that one of the reasons I wanted to talk today about the topic stereotypes, nationalism and fascism, is actually the beautiful coincidence that John Boehner said yesterday that the United States of America have the best healthcare system in the world. This is something that should give us, allow us a moment of reflection for many reasons. First of all, and here I'm not going to talk about healthcare, obviously, it's really a stark statement in a situation where we know that 40 million people of a nation that considers herself to be God's own country and that considers herself to be a nation of manifest destiny, that this is a stark statement if we consider this reality. But secondly, I think the interesting aspect of this is that Boehner does what a good politician is doing. He talks to his community, which is a construction, actually, of the society. When Boehner says we have the best healthcare system, he says we America. And in the moment he does not only represent his community of Republican voters, to which he is appealing to, but to the whole country. So he is making a statement actually for a society. And this is a passo totu, an example for what is happening everywhere still in the world. Boehner in America could be called Haider, who has deceased in the middle in Austria, or, I mean, I don't want to compare him with other villains because it's not that I want to actually use him or criticize him. As I said, he's just being a good politician. But the point I'm making is he is generalizing a community to a society level. And this is at the roots of our today's international, of the problems of our international system, which was created in the 50s in the belief that actually eventually after the Second World War and after the First World War, we can create on the basis of the rule of international law a just organization of the world that eventually will allow to live in peace. And in this sense, the founding fathers of the world, of today's world system were very much inspired by Immanuel Kant, whose text we can read up there. He says, the social relations between the various peoples of the world in narrow or wide circles have now advanced everywhere so far that the violation of rights in one place of the earth is felt all over it. This was 1795. Today, we are still not there, despite globalism, despite internet, Facebook, despite global media, CNN and so on and so on. We know very little, for example, about human rights violation, and I take a random country. I take Greece. In Greece, we have 45,000 people who have no human rights because they are refugees imprisoned, some of them for years. We don't talk about people are dying on the borders of Greece when they go over the river from Turkey to Greece. Nobody talks about this. Everybody talks about the debt that Greek banks have to the European Union, but also to Chase Manhattan Bank. This is, if you open the New York Times, the violation of human rights in Greece is not felt here at the New Museum. If I hadn't talked about it, you wouldn't even know about it. And I can give you many, many more examples of this. So, in fact, the reason why I'm talking about Kant, of course, is that the invitation comes from Aaron Levy, who has involved and invited us and the International Peace Institute to think of the text of Immanuel Kant in 1795 and its meaning today. The invitation was to reread it, to see where we are and to see what we can do with it. But in order to see this, I think, we have really also to look at both the realities in which we live, but also at the theoretical foundations on which this text was developed. And I have learned a lot about Thomas Hobbes, most of which I have already forgotten, but I tend to think that the theoretical foundations of today's world, unfortunately, lie much more or are much closer to his thoughts, which came out of the many civil wars and problems he faced in Britain and France in the 16th century, but not in this era of enlightenment in the wake of the French Revolution that Kant saw from Königsberg, Kaliningrad, dreaming of a better world. Because still, we live in a world where power is actually the first currency of world affairs. It's at the end of the day, it's still power that we are talking about. And it's not only the United States, but it's also smaller countries that are fighting for influence, for attention. And it's not only countries, it's corporations, it's interest groups, and so on. Of course, it's very much diversified. This discourse has been, of course, happening. This critical discourse has been happening over decades, and sometimes it comes stronger, sometimes it's less strong present, but it's still a matter of fact that everywhere in the world where we look at, we have power struggles. If we look at the Middle East, if we look at Afghanistan and Iraq, I don't need to tell you that. We have our own problems in our backyard, I call it, which is Europe, former Yugoslavia. We're talking about the Caucasus. I mean, there is an incredible fight about influence in Caucasus and Central Asia between the United States and Russia and Iran, and the European Union tries to play a role. China is coming in. And at the end, as I said before, it's all about power in the first place, and all other things come second. And the way power is constructed, and here I come back to what I said at the beginning, it's constructing by appealing to communities, extrapolating then to a larger good, which is the society, which is maybe peace, which is justice. Everybody actually at the end of the day is fighting in the name of a greater idea of some justice that can be discussed later. But in the first place, the appeal goes to a community from which we try, or let's say power tries to increase legitimacy. And I think it's worthwhile to indulge in a moment on the exact definitions of the words that we are looking at, and then you can think for yourself where we stand in today's society. So for these reasons, I have actually checked the Encyclopedia Britannica, I have checked Wikipedia, I have checked a few other German sources, and I start with stereotypes, which comes from Greek etymology. Stereos, firm, solid, impression, type, the typographical element. A cliché was in the French word for the printing surface for a stereotype. I make it shorter now, but the sociologist Charles Hirst said, "One reason for stereotypes is the lack of personal, concrete familiarity that individuals have with persons in other racial or ethnic groups. Lack of familiarity encourages the lumping together of unknown individuals. Stereotypes focus upon and thereby exaggerate differences between groups. Competition between groups minimizes similarities and magnifies differences." Encyclopedia Britannica, this was Wikipedia. "The most common kinds of stereotypes are rationally unsupported generalizations about the putative characteristics of all or nearly all members of a given social group. Most people learn many stereotypes during childhood," so we are talking here about the sociological analysis. But let us think a moment about Arizona and this law of, or against immigrants. This is something which we have everywhere, also in Europe, and I think I don't need to create further explanations on this. Let's talk about nationalism. Here we found beautiful, I found beautiful differences in the definition of nationalism in Britain, the United States, and in Europe, in particular in German countries. Nationalism is something negative. Here, nationalism, in Britain, it's something better, and here is something really beautiful. I didn't actually know about this. Nationalism, ideology based on the premise that the individual's loyalty and devotion to the nation-state surpass other individual or group interests. New nationalism, in U.S. history, political philosophy of Theodore Roosevelt, an espousal of active federal invention to promote social justice and the economic welfare of the underprivileged. Roosevelt used the phrase new nationalism in a 1910 speech in which he attempted to reconcile the liberal and conservative wings of the Republican Party. His program called for a great increase of federal power to regulate interstate industry and sweeping program of social reform designed to put human rights above property rights. With the Republican vote split, Roosevelt and his new nationalism went down to defeat before Democratic candidate Woodrow Wilson and his new freedom. So back to history, actually. I'm not going to read the German definition of that I found in Wikipedia, but it's marked by with the word nationalistic. You find ethnicity in there. You find claim to supremacy over other nations in there. You find tribalism in there. With tribalism, we are back to Max Weber's definition of community. Fascism. I hope I can find it. The most important one. Okay. Philosophy of government that stresses the primacy and glory of the state, unquestioning obedience to its leader, subordination of the individual will to the state's authority, and harsh suppression of dissent. Martial virtues are celebrated, while liberal and democratic values are disparaged. This was Encyclopedia Britannica. Wikipedia says, fascists believe in a nation, that the nation is an organic community that requires strong leadership, singular collective identity, and the will and ability to commit violence and wage war in order to keep the nation strong. They claim that culture is created by the collective national security and its state, that cultural ideas are what give individuals identity, and thus they reject individualism. Viewing the nation as an integrated collective community, they see pluralism as a dysfunctional aspect of society and justify a totalitarian state as a means to represent the nation in its entirety. Fascists reject and resist the autonomy of cultural or ethnic groups who are not considered part of the fascist nation and who refuse to assimilate or are unable to be assimilated. So this is pretty much the Anglo-Saxon definition, because whenever you read, and I'm not going to translate this, a German definition of fascism, you will also find the word racism, which is even more exclusive than the reference to ethnicity. And if I recall, and this is also, I think, one of the reasons that Aaron invited me to speak here. If I recall the European experience in Yugoslavia, then actually we find all elements of the definition of fascism in at least the Wikipedia description. But if we continue our discussion, I mean, you have totalitarian power, you have, of course, the use of the Gemeinschafts idea to the society, you have anti-democratic exclusion of opponents, you have the rallying, the modernizing element in there, and you have the ethnicity in there. And by the way, you have violence in there, which is actually much missing in this definition. And to a certain extent, you have racism there, because it was clear for Muslims, Serbs, and Croats that by definition, a coexistence of their ethnicities in one state is impossible. And this is why hundreds of thousands of people had to die, and 2 million people were displaced in a nation of 25 million people in 1991. Today we have 7 countries, 7 new members in the United Nations, where we'll have our seminar, as an outcome of actually a renewed fascist ideology that is as alive as it was ever in the 20th century. And I am sure if we have a longer discussion here that we'll find more examples of fascism as present as an ideology, of course disguised with other names, much closer to this country or much closer in my country, even in Austria. It stated this in the presence of a very important deputy to the Austrian parliament. So it's everywhere. And it's with us. And this is why I think it's important to look at these three notions, stereotypes, nationalism, fascism, as a kind of mirror image or as a kind of intellectual exercise about Kant's essay and its meaning today. Thank you very much.